Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Prince was captured on canvas by Andy Warhol in 1984 in a series of silkscreen artworks, stylized variations on a photograph of the rock star. The legal battle over Warhol's famed Prince series didn't begin until after both their deaths. And this March, photographer Lynn Goldsmith convinced the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that Warhol's Prince series was not fair use and infringed the copyright of her photo of Prince. The Second Circuit decided to revisit that controversial decision after the Supreme Court's landmark ruling about fair use in Google versus Oracle. However, this week, the Second Circuit basically said, "We were right the first time." Joining me to put this all in perspective is intellectual property litigator Terrence Ross, a partner at Katten Muchin Rosenman. Terry, give us the background of the case.
So, June, the plaintiff in this lawsuit is Lynn Goldsmith, who's sort of prominent photographer, and in 1981 taken a series of photographs of the musical artist Prince. And those photographs are relatively well known. At some point after that, Andy Warhol did a very impressionistic work of Prince that was based unabashedly on her photograph from 1981. After his death in 2016, Vanity Fair used on its cover one of those Andy Warhol prints, the artist, and Lynn Goldsmith sued, alleging that that constituted copyright infringement because they did not have her authorization to use what she believed was her work. The Andy Warhol Foundation, which controls all of his works, argued that what Andy Warhol had done with her photograph was transformative, and therefore the fair use defense protected against any copyright infringement. And that argument prevailed in the district court, the lower court. Lynn Goldsmith appealed the decision to the Second Circuit, which is the appellate court for New York and Connecticut, and the Second Circuit agreed with her. They said fair use defense would not apply here because what Andy Warhol had done to her photograph was not transformative. After that decision came down, the United States Supreme Court issued its ruling in the Google versus Oracle case, which is also a copyright decision, although involving source code in the computer context. As a result of that decision from the Supreme Court, the Andy Warhol Foundation went back to the Second Circuit and asked the Second Circuit to reconsider its decision in light of the new Supreme Court ruling and to see if they might come out in a different manner on the fair use question.
So the Second Circuit considers this again, but comes to the same conclusion. Did they really take Google Oracle into consideration?
Well, I think they did take it into consideration. I think what happened here is that when Google v. Oracle first was issued by the Supreme Court, a lot of people, including copyright practitioners, did not fully grasp the import of it. The media certainly treated it as if it was a case that changed copyright law. And I think the media was more focused on the result of the decision than on what the decision actually said. And because of the sheer length of it, I think it took time for people to read and understand and comprehend it and appreciate what the Supreme Court was saying. So the Second Circuit receives this request from the Andy Warhol Foundation saying, oh, the Supreme Court's new decision in Google v. Oracle changes everything in the copyright field for fair use. You got to go back and rethink it. And without really taking the time to consider whether or not that was true, the Second Circuit granted the request for a rehearing. They then took briefs from both the parties on why Google v. Oracle was meaningful to the dispute. And after thinking about it, came to the conclusion, you know, Google versus Oracle wasn't as game-changing as some people were representing it to be, and certainly did not change anything in this particular case.
When we spoke about this last, I was astonished that the Second Circuit unanimously found that Andy Warhol's work was not transformative. I mean, he transformed a Campbell soup can, and this print series looks so different from the photograph, to me at least.
So I won't disagree with you because I'm not an art critic. The problem the Second Circuit had with what the trial court did, and it just came straight out and said this, that the district court played art critic in this case, and that we have cautioned, the Second Circuit has cautioned since 1920, trial judges should not be art critics or music critics. They are not allowed to use their view of whether or not a piece of art is transformative as determinative. In essence, the court was saying, look, we think you've got to take an approach that does not require the court to be an expert, because courts are not experts, whether it comes to literary publishing, music publishing, art. They're not experts. You can't do what you did. And then they pointed to a whole bunch of similarities between the photo of Prince and Andy Warhol's rendering of Prince, including the way his hair was parted and portrayed. That was a counterbalance to what the district court had pointed out, which you just now, June, pointed out.
But isn't the Second Circuit in making that decision also being an art critic?
One could certainly argue that that's true, that at some point or other, somebody is playing art critic here. It goes to the nature of the test. In order for fair use to apply, there's a four-factor test. And here, the key, again, focused on by the Second Circuit, and the Supreme Court has said this itself in previous cases, is whether or not the work is transformative. Because if the allegedly infringing work is transformative, whatever that means, then the fair use arguably should apply, notwithstanding how the other three factors come out. And that's the real problem. Once we bought into this linguistic box of whether or not something was transformative or not, words which, by the way, are not in the statute, but once we've applied those judicially created word transformative to this, you get into a box as to who makes that decision and how do you go about making that decision, especially when it comes to art or music, which are inherently creative processes on which even critics can disagree.
Were you surprised that the Second Circuit said we were right the first time?
I think everyone was surprised by the decision that just came out from the Second Circuit. And it seemed to me that the only reason to grant a rehearing, indeed a rehearing specifically directed at how Google v. Oracle impacted the case, was to say we got it wrong. And the Supreme Court has now showed us the way, and we're going to change course and reverse ourselves. And they did not do that. At the Supreme Court, they have a doctrine where sometimes they will agree to hear a case, and then after really studying it carefully and thinking about it, they go, you know, this was a mistake. And they dismiss it as improvidently granted. And that's what the Second Circuit probably should have done here, is simply say, you know, we were right the first time. Google v. Oracle doesn't change the law, and leave it at that. Instead, they decided to go through with a decision after receiving all the papers on rehearing, in which they reiterated what they'd said before, but calling out that Google v. Oracle requires a context-specific application of the fair use doctrine, and in the context of this particular case, there is no fair use.
The Warhol Foundation says it hasn't decided what it's going to do next. They could take this to the Supreme Court.
So yes, they could. They have two options. The first option is they could ask for a rehearing en banc of the Second Circuit. What that would mean is that they think that this particular three-judge panel of the Second Circuit has gotten it wrong, that previous cases in the Second Circuit dictate a different outcome. And the way it works is that a three-judge panel is not allowed to change the law in a circuit. They have to abide by prior cases. And in particular, there's the Carew case going back a few years, which involved changing photographs of some Rastafarians in Jamaica by adding doodles and drawings onto the photographs and then selling them as independent works of art. And in that case, the Second Circuit had ruled that that constituted fair use. There was no infringement. And so the option that the Andy Warhol Foundation has here is to ask for a rehearing en banc and specifically say, we think this decision violates the Second Circuit's precedent in that Carew case and other decisions. And if a majority of all the judges on the Second Circuit agree that there's a problem here, that the two cases need to be reconciled in some way, they can grant a rehearing en banc, get new briefing, have a new oral argument in front of all 13 judges, and then they will issue a new decision that incorporates the views of all of the judges on the Second Circuit. And it seems to me that that would be the most logical step for the Andy Warhol Foundation to take here, because there is a real question in my mind and in the mind of most copyright practitioners as to whether this current decision between Goldsmith and the Andy Warhol Foundation deviated from the way the Second Circuit had approached the fair use doctrine in the past. So that's, I think, the strongest approach they have. If that is denied, they then have the option of appealing to the Supreme Court.
Not that the Second Circuit cares about my opinion, but personally, I would love it if they took this case en banc, because I don't see how you reconcile the Prince series not being transformative and the Carew being transformative.
And June, I don't see any intellectually principled way to distinguish the two cases. I think the Second Circuit en banc has to say, we got one wrong and the other one right, and going forward, this is the way things are going to be done. And I will say this as a copyright practitioner with many clients and cases in New York, we need some guidance from the Second Circuit on what is fair use in these cases. And if they are unwilling to do that, it would be nice to get some guidance from the Supreme Court, because we are left unable to advise our clients often, or unfortunately using weasel words and saying, well, it could go this way, it could go this way, it's just too hard to tell, which doesn't help the client very much, because clients want certainty, and it's what's missing here in the fair use area. And it would be nice if either the Second Circuit or the Supreme Court gave us some certainty.
Thanks, Terry. That's Terrence Ross of Catton, Huch & Rosenman.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Many college students returning to the classroom this fall will face an ultimatum: get vaccinated or go home. About 750 colleges and universities are requiring vaccines for students or employees, according to a database by the Chronicle of Higher Education. The FDA's full approval of the Pfizer vaccine is a game changer, putting the COVID vaccine on par with the other vaccines that colleges and universities require. But COVID vaccine mandates for students have triggered a growing wave of lawsuits against higher education institutions. My guest is Lawrence Gostin, director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University.
Should we expect more mandates and more challenges to the mandates?
Yes, we're going to expect both. I think that now that the FDA has fully licensed the Pfizer vaccine and soon will fully license the Moderna vaccine, more and more colleges and universities and indeed businesses and local governments are going to require vaccines as a condition for coming back to school or to work. And I think that that's entirely lawful. America is a highly litigious society, so there can continue to be lawsuits. But I do foresee that the courts are going to throw these lawsuits out, and eventually vaccine mandates are going to be becoming the norm in the United States for a safe return to work or to the classroom.
So what are some of the arguments that are made against vaccine mandates?
Well, you know, the legal arguments are very weak. Most of these lawsuits were predicated on the idea that it was emergency use authorization. So that argument melts away now that Pfizer is fully licensed and soon Moderna. And so there are very few good legal arguments. I mean, I suppose they could argue that colleges or businesses don't have the power to do it. But the truth is that colleges and businesses have been doing it for years, you know, with influenza and other vaccines. And so I don't think that those arguments are very strong. You know, there are also kind of ethical arguments that somehow this invades a person's freedom or liberty. And, you know, to that I just say this, you know, anyone has the absolute right to make any decision for their own health and safety, but they don't have the right to expose other people to a dangerous infectious disease. You don't have the right to go unvaccinated and unmasked in a crowded classroom or a crowded workspace. That just exposes others to danger. And there's a long tradition in the United States that you have your freedom, but your freedom ends when you pose a significant risk to others, and that's what unvaccinated people do.
I understand that some students are claiming they have a constitutional right to go to college in person and unvaccinated.
It's almost a laughable legal argument. there is no right to go to college. That's why we have an admission system and why we give colleges discretion at who they admit and who they don't. And colleges also have an absolute right, not just a right, but a responsibility to create a safe workplace. Remember, they're acting in loco parentis, and they need to ensure that these young people under their care are safe and secure. So there is no constitutional right to do that. I don't know. It's almost a made-up right. But I suppose you can claim to have a right to do anything. And, you know, the truth is that nobody's denying them the right to go to college or university. They're literally just saying, you know, if you want to go, you have to go safely.
Are these challenges new, or are these challenges similar to ones made in the past to other vaccines? You mentioned influenza, but maybe measles, mumps, you know, are these the same kind of challenges?
Yes, but I have to say that all of these vaccine challenges have really been unsuccessful. You mentioned measles and mumps, the childhood immunization schedule that is required for students to go to K through 12. Courts have upheld them. Supreme Court has upheld it twice. And so these are not good legal arguments. But the truth is that I've never seen an epidemic that was politicized the way that COVID-19 is. People accept that, you know, you need to get vaccinated, you know, for measles, mumps, rubella, and other infectious diseases. And there's no argument about it because that we live in a well-ordered society where we look out for one another. But this is just every neutral public health tool is now controversial. Masks are controversial. Vaccines are controversial. Lockdowns were controversial. And basically, you know, nobody wants to, at least I don't, to shame and blame people who are unvaccinated. And I don't want to take away their health insurance or make it more expensive for them. Many of them are really decent, good Americans trying to make the best decision for themselves and their families. But at the end of the day, we need to make sure that we look out for one another. And it's not all about me, me, me. It's about what ethical obligations I have to my family, to my neighbors, to my country, so that we can all be safe and secure. And so vaccines, masks, and other things, they're just public health tools. They're not Republican. They're not Democrat. They're not trying to punish or blame anyone. They're literally just scientific tools that we need to ensure a greater level of health and safety and security, which is what all we want. And it just doesn't make sense for us to litigate over it.
Universities. Earlier this month, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit refused to block Indiana University's vaccine mandate. What can we read into the fact that Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett refused without explanation to block the school's mandate?
I mean, I think we can just simply assume that even one of the most conservative justices that we have, Justice Coney Barrett, is not prepared to strike down a provision that's clearly lawful and it's clearly needed for the public's health.
So now a dozen states have bans on vaccine mandates that apply to institutions of higher education. How does that play in? What part does that play in this?
Plays an important part. You know, I've worked in public health for over 30 years, and I've seen many, many times when states or political leaders have failed to take necessary and important public health action to protect the public. But I don't think I've ever seen states and governors and legislators actually blocking local governments and school districts from protecting themselves. It just makes no sense to actually ban something that the public relies on for its health and safety, and that there's an overwhelming scientific consensus that it's vital and important and safe, vaccines and masks. And why, you know, an elected political leader would betray the public trust that way, I have no idea. It just seems like a deep betrayal of their oath of office. Having said that, you know, states do have very wide powers to regulate colleges, universities, and businesses that are operating solely within their state. And probably many of these are going to be upheld.
So you think that if one of these cases goes to court in a state where there's a ban on vaccine mandates, that the ban will win out over the vaccine mandates?
Well, on the basis that states have the right to regulate businesses and states have the right to require local jurisdictions, counties, cities, school boards, to do what the state wants. The state does have that power. You know, having said all that, you know, there in Texas, there's a widespread revolt against Governor Abbott's ban on masking and vaccinations in schools and other places. And many are defying the governor's orders. And there's been a lot of litigation. So far, the courts have not been prepared to to uphold Governor Abbott's order. And they've said, you know, why is the governor preventing local officials and school districts from doing what they think is necessary to protect the health of students and others? But ultimately, I mean, I'm not sure how the courts will decide. On a policy basis, it's crazy and should be struck down. But on a legal basis, state legislators and governors do have authority over businesses. They can regulate them. They even locked them down during the pandemic, and courts upheld that. So it seems to me that these are extraordinarily unwise laws and executive orders. But in many states, they'll probably be upheld.
So that would give the state the power to tell a university that you have to admit this student who is not vaccinated.
Yes, ultimately, because if the college is not able to require proof of vaccination under state law, just like, you know, the state public health department set rules, you know, they say you need to have certain social distancing in schools, or you can't gather at certain density levels, or that there needs to be indoor mask mandates. Those are all things that the state can do. They're wise, they're sensible, you know, but the question is really boils down to this. Can the state do something that's crazy if it's within its powers? And, you know, the court's going to have to decide that. But they're judges, and they can't be basing it on upon policy. They have to look at what the powers of the state are. And the state, as I say, you know, locked entire cities down. And if they can do that, they can pretty much do anything.
So then what's going to end up happening is you're going to have a patchwork of different laws across the country.
We do already. We do have a patchwork of different laws across the country. You know, many parts of the country require indoor masking. Some don't. There is no national uniformity and consistency. And when you're dealing with a pandemic, you know, the SARS-CoV-2 pathogen, you know, doesn't know that it's in Texas or Florida or New York, and it's going to spread either way. And so we need, you know, national consistency and uniformity based upon the tenets of science. You know, we have to remember that there is really good scientific evidence that vaccines are safe and effective, and that masks work to reduce spread of the infection, including the Delta variant.
Let's say it goes to court. In the states that banned the COVID vaccine,
if these same states allow vaccine mandates for the childhood illnesses, how do they square that discrepancy?
Yeah, I mean, they shouldn't obviously distinguish. I mean, I suppose they could have distinguished before because these childhood vaccines were fully licensed and COVID-19 vaccines were not. But now that distinction has vanished. So, you know, from a rational point of view, the distinction really has no merit. But that's what the states have done. You know, in many cases, it's been a law that's been passed by the state legislature and signed by the governor. And the state does have a lot of authority to regulate colleges, universities, businesses that are operating wholly within the state. I suppose the state Supreme Court could say, well, listen, you're acting in an arbitrary and irrational manner and strike it down on that basis. But they tend to give the legislature wide discretion in setting policy. I mean, this policy, as I say, you know, just not to put too fine a point on it, is nuts. But there you go.
Thanks for being on the Bloomberg Law Show. That's Lawrence Gostin, director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University.
And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.